2025. Or find the podcasts by searching 3CR's Radical Radio on your favourite podcast app.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we are broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7 in the morning. Good morning, Leela.
Good morning, Priya.
How's it going?
Well, what just came to mind is the question of, is it appropriate to vocal sim on radio? Because, like, it kind of seems like the ideal place to do it, but also the least appropriate place.
I think it is appropriate to do it, but also I think you don't even need to, like, mention it. You can just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
just say your things, and how will people know exactly? How will people know if that's a vocal sim or not? There's just simply no way to tell.
Yes, that's right. It's just part of my radio charm.
Exactly. There's just something about the Thursday Breakfast Show that keeps me coming back. Could it be the vocal stims? We have a packed show for our final live program this year. A reminder that we are going on break for summer, and we will be back with you live again from the 22nd of January. But that doesn't mean don't tune in. Definitely stay locked to 3CR 855 AM, where across the Thursday Breakfast Show, at least, we're going to be bringing you a bunch of curated segments of some of our favorite interviews across 2025, with some amazing themes, including around looking at policing in prisons, investigating environmental actions, I believe, is one of them. Was it?
Yes.
What were the other ones?
And we also have our disability justice and
alcohol and other drug public health stuff.
Yes, which actually I think maybe that is our theme this year, not disability justice. And housing. Did you
housing also
that?
It's amazing. We've covered so much stuff that it is impossible to tell actually what's coming up. So I think you should just stay tuned in and you'll find out yourself.
It's true, and it's beautiful, I think, that a lot of our themes relate to intersectional topics, and they do all connect. So
yeah,
listen to all four.
Exactly. It that's what makes it hard to select what goes in what theme, because we are so lucky to be able to have guests on who do speak to how multiple issues interconnect, and this week is no exception. So we are going to start off by hearing a conversation between Danielle and Chev about late diagnosis, privilege, and getting services from an inadequate system, as well as stigma and disability inclusion in activist spaces, which was originally broadcast as part of 3CR's Disability Day special broadcast on the 3rd of December 2025. And you just heard how to listen back to that.
And after that, we have a very real Christmas special. The end of the year holiday period can be very hard for queer people for so many different reasons. And whether or not you celebrate Christmas, it's a time that can be really isolating due to friends and community going away on holiday and less access to healthcare over public holidays. There are increased financial pressures and constant reminders of idealized family relationships. And today, to learn more about supporting yourself and others during this time, we're going to hear from Beck Smith from QLife, a peer support service run by community for community. Beck has spent the better part of the past decade working and volunteering in the digital mental health sector and currently serves at LGBTIQ+ Health Australia as the Associate Director for QLife, which runs in partnership with 2010 New South Wales, Switchboard Victoria, Living Proud WA and Diverse Voices Queensland.
Amazing. I hope that people stay tuned for that, because I'm sure it will be full of really important resources and information as we navigate the end of year period. After that, we'll be joined by Nina Tori Henderson and Kerry Landwehr from Building Action Now, or BAN, who speak with us about a recently launched open letter campaign that urges Minister for Housing and Building Harriet Shing to halt plans to demolish Melbourne's 44 high-rise public housing towers. And now BAN is a group of professionals from the built environment industry, and they argue that in addition to a lack of appropriate consideration of the plan's impact on residents, the government is still failing to provide a reasonable justification for wholesale demolition and redevelopment of the towers, despite significant social and environmental as well as economic costs. And then after that, we are joined by Ilo Diaz from the Centre Against Racial Profiling to unpack the function, declaration and impact of designated areas in Victoria. Now, Ilo, who I organise alongside at the Centre, has been tracking the announcement of designated areas around Victoria for the past few years, looking at the frequency and duration of these zones where police are additionally empowered to do things like search people without a warrant, move them along and remove face coverings. And listeners will be familiar with the fact that last week Human Rights Law Centre filed a challenge in federal court against the Victorian Assistant Police Commissioner's recent declaration of the entire Melbourne CBD and surrounds as a designated area for 6 months, starting from the 30th of November this year.
And finally today, disability support worker and community organiser Lana Laham joins us to discuss Fun Run for Mutual Aid, a community-powered event bringing people together to move, connect and raise funds for life-saving mutual aid to Gazan, Sudanese and First Nations people. The main Fun Run event will take place on Sunday, February 1st at 9 a.m. Footscray Park along the fully paved Maribyrnong River Trail. But you can run or walk on the day at a time that suits you, and there are so many ways to get involved. Sign up and pledge to raise $1,000 for these important initiatives by asking your friends and family to sponsor you. Walk with your pram, dog, mobility scooter on the sealed path, or sprint away. This is your chance to make every step count.
Amazing. And we will have information on how to sign up in our show notes. But for now, we'll be back with you shortly for the news headlines.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 18th of December. As investigations continue into the Bondi attack, which saw the targeted killing of 15 Jewish people at a Chanukah event celebration, the New South Wales government has flagged possible restrictions on protests that they deem terror threats. Community and civil society groups have criticised Premier Chris Minns' move to give police powers to refuse protest applications, saying those restrictions will inflame tensions during a time of mourning and undermine democratic rights. Earlier this week at the Bondi Beach Memorial, police removed Jewish activist Michelle Birkin after she wore a keffiyeh while mourning victims. Birkin and other community members attending the memorial site said the incident highlighted unequal enforcement and the politicisation of grief in response to the Israeli flag being flown at the memorial site.
In other news, an Australian Institute of Criminology report has found that 33 First Nations people have died in custody in the period 2024 to 2025, the highest number recorded since 1980. More than three decades after the Royal Commission into the Aboriginal Deaths in Custody was handed down, hundreds of recommendations remain largely unimplemented. Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe has urged the Albanese government to take urgent national action to reduce incarceration and prevent further deaths, arguing that the crisis reflects systemic failure rather than isolated state and territory issues.
Also in news this week, the Queensland government has introduced an electoral amendment bill that would remove voting rights from thousands of people in prison, serving sentences of 1 year or more. The amendment is drawing criticism in the context of overrepresentation of First Nations people in custody and increasingly punitive justice policies. Critics warn the proposal would disproportionately impact First Nations people and further exclude communities most affected by incarceration from democratic participation.
In national news, the federal government has announced $44 million in new funding to reduce unlawful Centrelink payment cancellations under the targeted compliance framework, including more staff at Services Australia to review cancellation decisions. However, critics, including Anti-Poverty Centre, point to a recent Commonwealth Ombudsman report that highlighted systemic failures in welfare compliance, warning the funding does not address widespread payment suspensions, poor oversight of outsourced providers, or the harm caused to hundreds of thousands of welfare recipients with limited plans for compensation.
And finally, in headlines this week, the Supreme Court of Victoria will hand down its decision on the class action appeal made by public housing residents challenging the demolition of the high-rise flats in North Melbourne and Flemington on Friday morning. The class action, filed by Inner Melbourne Community Legal, alleged that the Victorian government breached the human rights of public housing tenants at 33 Alfred Street, North Melbourne, and 12 Holland Court and 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington. The action was dismissed in April, but has been appealed by IMCL on behalf of public housing tenants. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 18th of December. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM and it is 7:12 in the morning. And now we're going to listen back to a conversation between Danielle and Chev about late diagnosis, privilege, getting services from an inadequate system, stigma and disability inclusion in activist spaces, which was originally broadcast as part of 3CR's Disability Day special broadcast on the 3rd of December 2025. In this year's theme, Right Relations and Innovations, they explore disabled people's visions of a safe future for everyone and the relationships and innovations that can get us there.
A little piece of advice if anyone's listening who, you know, has health issues, who has a healthcare card through Centrelink, you will be eligible for the Medicare safety net. And what that means is that if you spend, I think it's over like, it's like, $800 and something out of pocket on medical appointments, you then, once you hit that target, you then get 80% back. Why it's set up like this, I have no idea. But I guess how basically I've approached this is just kind of conceptualize and be like, okay, if I can like save up $800 to spend on medical appointments, then once I hit that target, then they become like significantly cheaper and I can actually, you know, afford more. And I guess sort of like the earlier in the calendar year that you hit that target, the, you know, I guess the more affordable your medical, your GP appointments, and unfortunately just those five allied health appointments that you do through the GP chronic disease management plan, but you will get 80% back for those five appointments after you've reached the target. And, you know, I mean, $800, that's like three quarters of the DSP payment. It's a lot of money, but that's my hot tip for people out there.
Yeah. And also just mentioning the GPs and how connected your condition is with GP services. And in the last few years, the number of actual bulk billing GPs has declined to the point of it's almost impossible, and that they only bulk bill when you have a pension card. And And I had to, you know, change GPs again because the one I was at even stopped bulk billing those with pension cards. And it just shows, like, that the people treating you, how disconnected they are from the reality of our survival issues and the pension, the pension rates. Yeah.
Yeah, the math ain't math.
And did you want to talk about your experience in the activist community and what can people do and what's our ask, I guess?
Yeah, I guess my experience in a lot of ways has been limited quite significantly by my disability. You know, I've been predominantly housebound for many years, and so, you know, being able to, you know, attend IRL to actions, activist spaces is very limited. And that is also made harder by, you know, in many ways a very understandable concern, because there's been so much, you know, police crackdown on activist work and, yeah, violence by the state towards people engaging in activist work and, you know, advocating for a better world. People are very concerned around security. And so I guess there is sort of it means that people are reluctant to, you know, offer meetings on Zoom a lot of the time. And I guess those things that would make it a lot more accessible for people who are housebound. But I guess a really positive experience I've had is, you know, I guess getting together with a bunch of other CRIP activists and disabled activists and sort of making an online space and making a sort of an organism together to sort of do some organizing, which we named SLO, which is the SICO Liberation Organism. It's been really cool to connect, you know, with other people, and it sort of, this all came out with, I guess, like people wanting to be involved in Palestine action but not being able to access it. And yeah, so it's been wonderful in many ways, but it has also been hard, you know, when you have only people with disabilities kind of siloed together trying to do activism together, and a lot of us are, you know, are very limited because of our, you know, energy disabilities in sort of, you know, how much we can participate. And that has been definitely been a challenge. And there's been some amazing stuff we've done, but there's also been a lot of burnout. And I guess I would love to be in a world where we were able to do more collaborative work with pre-disabled people, as I like to refer to able-bodied people. Because pretty much everyone becomes disabled at some point.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be really cool if, you know, to be able to do a bit more like mixed organizing, that I guess people could be a bit more cognizant of ways to include disabled people and housebound people in organizing, because, you know, there's a lot of work that can be done from home. And there's a lot of support that can be done from home.
Yeah. I just wanted to jump in, since you're being so positive, with the critique that doesn't help, I guess. Yeah. So, you know, some of us, late diagnosis being age 35, so I've lived a fairly able-bodied life. And then going through that, you know, gaslighting yourself, the system not, you know, gaslighting you, and that sort of survival mode and constantly fighting for validation and your symptoms being believed and validated. But as someone who can still stand on their two feet, and you can't see my disability physically, and I still, I'm 44, I look about, yeah, about that, not too old. I find that, yeah, just it was like every time trying to set boundaries and talk about my capacity limits with other activists without being, you know, oh, but we all have mental health. And I think that this overuse of mental health and the misuse of the word trauma by, you know, not only activists but the middle class and general society is really invalidating of and yet just not appropriate. But it sort of leads to us burning out from trying to, you know, express boundaries and be validated, and then going into isolation and not being able to connect anymore in my experience to, you know, then the really like obvious and physical things, like it should be a no-brainer to offer Zoom links for planning meetings, you know. And we talked previously about operational security, I think you called it, OPSEC, being like a scapegoat for activists who have more traditional, old, like often older members of the activist community having more traditional means are the ones who are more likely to invalidate some a psychosocial disability and something that they can't see. You know, they're suddenly suffering and they're, you know, as you said, pre-disabled, they're suddenly learning their body and they're becoming aging and their effect, you know, their own health, and they're seeing the effects of life, but they, you know, this OPSEC is an excuse not to use Zoom or online components to include the disability community when we're like a significant demographic of those facing the injustices of the medical, social security systems and housing systems. So yeah, I'm being pretty straight up about it because I'm pretty frustrated. And yeah, just, you know, and then the other basic things is like just the assumption and not being able to believe someone. We need to believe each other at face value. And if someone's standing there and you go, like, a whole box of flyers, you know, you don't just hand it to them before without asking just because they're standing on 2 feet. Like, I actually have to say, oh, sorry, I can't carry that. Yeah, so assumptions is really hard as well.
Yeah, and I'm really sorry that you experienced that. It can be really tricky. I also have an invisible disability. I'm an ambulant wheelchair user, so that means that I can walk, and I also use a wheelchair because my ability to walk is very limited because of the debilitating fatigue I have. And yeah, it can be hard because people look at you and assume that you're young and fit, and it does take a lot of energy to advocate for yourself. And I think they're including, you know, disabled people in activism is not just about inclusivity for the sake of it. It is because, while of course, like, that's important, people with disabilities have so much incredible wisdom to offer, including the importance of communicating boundaries, the importance of pacing, the importance of knowing your limits. And there's so much burnout in activist spaces, you know, it's a bit of a trope because it's so common. And I have been able to share a lot of the wisdom that I have gained through my experience, you know, with my peers, and I've had importance of rest and pacing and doing things in a sustainable way. And, you know, if you can learn those lessons before you end up with a disability, whether that's, you know, in your 60s or your 80s or your 30s, that's really important. You know, one of the many, many pearls of wisdom that we can share. And anyone who's communicating kind of their limits with you, you know, that's a gift, and that should be received with grace and not with, you know, indignation or disbelief. And, you know, and if anyone doesn't accept that, you know, when you communicate it, that's nothing to do with you, and that's, you know, I'm sure just their kind of own internalized ableism with themselves that is sort of being reflected back, even though as hard as it can be to deal with.
Yeah, I agree. And I think at the end of the day, yeah, like also we've touched on the privilege and class issues, and we speak out because, you know, having that diagnosis is a privilege. But we're all fighting this system. If there wasn't a shortage and it wasn't based on a capitalist system of short supply and pitting us against each other, we can acknowledge that it would be a lot easier to work together as well. Did you want to, is there anything coming up with SIGO Liberation Organism, or do you want to plug that? Is there an Instagram?
Yes, we have the Instagram. It's slow action. Yeah, SLO underscore action. Been a bit quiet at the moment, but I'm sure we'll wake back up soon enough.
You've been listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and that was a conversation between Danielle and Chev that was originally broadcast as part of 3CR's Disability Day special broadcast on the 3rd of December 2025. And this year's theme was Right Relations and Innovations, and it focused on disabled people's visions of a safe future for everyone and the relationships and innovations that can get us there.
This week, I've personally been reflecting on how the end of year holiday period can be hard for queer people for so many different reasons. And whether or not you celebrate Christmas, it's a time that can be really isolating due to friends and community going away and less access to healthcare over public holidays. There are often increased financial pressures and constant reminders of idealised family relationships that can be really painful. So to learn more about supporting yourself and others during this time, we are joined now by Beck Smith from QLife in a conversation that Beck and I had yesterday. And QLife is a peer support service run by community for community. And Beck has spent the better part of the past decade working and volunteering in the digital mental health sector and currently serves at the LGBTIQ plus Health Australia as the Associate Director of QLife. Now, the following segment does contain mention of some sensitive mental health struggles. And while I encourage you to listen, you can tap back in 13 minutes if you're not up to hearing it. And if you need support now, you can call 13YARN on 139276 for First Nations listeners. You can also call Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. That's also a First Nations-specific crisis line. You can call Lifeline, which is open 24/7 on 131114, or you can call QLife for all our queer listeners on 1-800-184-527. During their updated December opening hours, 3pm to 9pm in your state's local time. Here's Beck.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Beck.
Thanks for having me.
My first question today covers some context. What unique challenges do trans and queer people in particular experience during the holiday period?
So the holiday period can be really joyful for some people, and then for others it can bring up grief and isolation, really difficult memories. It can activate struggles and past challenges with, you know, complex relationships. And this can be especially the case for people who might be estranged from their family of origin or have been through loss or might not feel safe or affirmed in traditional family settings. And then it's also important to recognise that supporting or playing the role of educator to friends and family and colleagues over that time can be really emotionally draining, carrying that emotional labour of having to explain what pronouns are to people, you know, over and over again.
Yeah, it can be triggering for so many reasons. And something that comes to mind as well is, you know, being queer, trans, LGBTQ plus is difficult in and of itself. But if you have any other intersections or vulnerabilities, it can be even harder. For young people in particular that don't have a robust social network around them, the social media ban for under 16s might increase isolation over this period. Can you expand on what the social media ban means for young people and also some alternatives to social media if young people are seeking connection during the holidays?
Absolutely. So we do know that many young people, and particularly trans and gender diverse and queer young people, or those who don't have the privilege of a supportive family or local community, you know, have used social media as a way of finding, you know, affirmation and participating as their authentic selves. And so it's really important to be alert to the risks of harm that can come without that safe and affirming space at home or in community. And so social media has really been a place that's offered connection and mental health support and access to community, particularly for those in regional and rural places as well, where that isolation can be really exaggerated. And so there are a few places that aren't affected by the ban currently. So from at the moment, places like Discord, Messenger, WhatsApp, they're all still on the staying list for now. But, there's also digital spaces like the Padlet website that 2010 in New South Wales have put up, which is a new online space for LGBTIQA plus folks 16 years and under. There are some really great tools on the Reach Out website. It is important to also keep in mind that AI tools can give great ideas, but they're not a replacement for real support. If somebody's struggling, it's important to reach out to a service that can provide that human support.
Thank you for that context. That's a really important reminder. So, Beck, what crisis supports are available in Victoria in particular over the holiday period? And what should someone who's either calling a crisis support line or contacting a peer support service like QLife, what should they expect their first time doing that?
Yeah, so there are a number of national services, crisis support and peer support services across the continent. And then, in every jurisdiction, there are different additional resources and services. So, for example, in Victoria, there's the Rainbow Door helpline that's run by Switchboard. And then there's also, some of the national services such as QLife. There's the Rainbow Sexual, Domestic and Family Violence Helpline. There are online resources and self-help hubs. One great example is Charlie, charlee.org.au, and also transhub.org.au. If you visit the QLife website on the Get Help page, there's a list of services and resources that are available outside of QLife's hours as well. And In emergency situations, 000 is there. And I just say this while acknowledging that there's a complex relationship between some emergency institutions and LGBTIQA plus communities, and that sometimes that relationship can carry risk on its own. So I want to acknowledge that too. In terms of contacting a helpline for the first time, it's really natural to feel nervous. And I suppose what to expect is that you'll speak to someone who's been trained to listen to you and create safety and not judge you. And, they won't be shocked by what you say. If you're speaking with somebody with shared lived experience, they've heard it before and, their job is to support you, and they might be able to share some things that worked for them. Your conversation is confidential. You can share as much or as little as you feel comfortable, and the person you speak to might offer perspective. They might help you make sense of what you're experiencing. They might explore some options together with you. It is important to remember that the helpline isn't there to fix everything for you, and they are there to help you feel less alone and maybe find a path forward, even just for a couple of hours. Most crisis support helplines do have some training around LGBTIQA plus communities experiences in the event that a queer specific helpline is not open during the time that somebody needs support.
Just circling back to the intersectional experience of some queer and LGBTQI plus people, what support is available for people who are First Nations, for people who don't use English, or those who are deaf and require an interpreter?
Absolutely. So 13 Yarn, 139276, is a 24-hour Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander crisis support service. There are web chat services offered at many of the helpline and crisis services, including QLife. Some also have a text option. And as well as that, there's the National Relay Service that can facilitate calls to any of the crisis lines through a relay officer. So contacting the National Relay Service can facilitate that. Mm. And, then as well, the Rainbow Door service that I mentioned earlier can, if you arrange with them, they can facilitate interpreter services for the language that you need to speak.
Thank you for that. Now, importantly, Are there any upcoming changes to operating hours that people need to be aware of?
So QLife will continue to operate from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. in each state's local time every day, including all of the public holidays. Rainbow Door have indicated they will be closed on the 25th of December and 1st of January. It's best to double check that information with the services websites directly. I understand that if you were to leave a message with Rainbow Door that somebody on one of their days where they or outside of their hours that somebody would be able to contact you back when they resume operations.
Thank you for that information. Now, speaking practically and in the sense of self-care, what can people with mental health challenges do now to prepare themselves a bit better for public holiday service closures or the potentiality of being a bit more isolated, like not having as many friends around or missing family or just feeling low?
Absolutely. So, yeah, one of the most protective things people can do is to stay connected in some way. And what, you know, what that looks like will, and what's possible will be different for everybody. It, you know, might involve reaching out to trusted friends or people who, you know, who are good listeners, planning ahead by figuring out which services operate through all the holidays. So, you know, many of the larger crisis lines do run 24/7. It can be helpful to create a bit of a support plan, writing down some coping strategies that you know that you find helpful or people that you can reach out to or warning signs to watch out for and which people are safe to contact. And then I suppose considering what kind of things about the holidays might activate difficult feelings for you, you know, planning an exit strategy from those things if possible, or giving yourself permission to skip things that compromise your well-being. There are also many LGBTIQA plus organisations that run holiday events or meetups or community meals, and I've seen that Drummond Street has a free Christmas Day breakfast on in Melbourne, and that there's a registration for that online. So these kinds of things can be a really powerful way to reduce that isolation and, you know, maybe even form some new connections during a time that might otherwise feel really, really lonely.
Yeah, thanks, Beck. That's great advice. I'm a big fan of making a little mental health care plan that you can text to people, or if you want to, you know, make a nice Google Doc or a spreadsheet and email it to people in advance. That's a really good way you can kind of ensure people around you are prepared and consenting to take care of you. And I feel like it lessens the stress of feeling like a burden if you are someone that struggles with mental health to give people notice that you might be reaching out.
Totally. And even like, yeah, for myself as well, like, you know, if I'm really elevated about something, my mind isn't going to be in that pragmatic space of, you know, being able to immediately remember what all the things on my list are. So, you know, it's helpful to just have that pre-ready in the notes app or somewhere so that in the moment you're not having to try and regulate yourself while also remembering how to do that.
Yeah, and it can be in the most basic format. Now, you touched on it a bit, saying that people want to help, but a lot of the time they don't know how. Do you have some tips for how friends, family, and community can support the safety of the people around us who are struggling?
Absolutely. So, yeah, so the holidays can be particularly tough for LGBTIQA plus people dealing with family rejection or having to hide parts of themselves or grieving chosen family. You know, just a little check-in can mean a lot. It can make a huge difference to just send a text says thinking of you or I'm here if you need anything. You know, if you're hosting events, make the effort to create inclusive spaces and you're, you know, just remember that you're queer and your trans friends are watching to see if you'll protect them. You know, use people's names and pronouns correctly, even if other people disregard that. If it's safe to call out problematic behavior, then do so. Offer practical support as well. You can invite somebody to join your celebration if they're alone, and, you know, respect if they say no, if they need some space. And I guess the last thing is, you know, it's important not to assume that everyone loves the holidays. And if you ask someone how they're doing, then be prepared to listen to the answer, and you know, not, you don't need to fix or minimize what that answer may be. But yeah, be prepared to hear that someone might not be doing okay. And you know, it's good that they would trust you to share that with you. That's a strength.
Beck, thank you so much for your time today and sharing some of that wisdom. Do you have anything else that you want to let people know or leave us with today?
Just that QLife is, you know, is here for you in solidarity, and looking forward to supporting community during this time when people need us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Layla.
You just heard from Beck Smith, who spoke to me yesterday a bit more about LGBTQI plus health, mental health over the holidays, and how to support yourself and others during this time. QLife is a peer support service run by community for community that offers phone and online support, and their updated opening hours from the 1st of December are 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. in your local state's time, and you can get in touch online with them at qlife.org.au.
You tune into Thursday Breakfast. It is 7:40 in the morning. I'll do a quick weather check. Right now in Narm, it feels like it's about 18 to 19 degrees, but we are facing a maximum of 36 degrees today. The UV is going to hit the extreme of about 13, so make sure that if you're out and about, you're wearing appropriate sun protection and you've got sunscreen on. And now we are joined by Nina Torrey Henderson and Kari Landwehr from Building Action Now, or BAN, who are speaking with us about a recently launched open letter campaign urging Minister for Housing and Building Harriet Shing to halt plans to demolish Melbourne's 44 high-rise public housing towers. BAN is a group of professionals from the built environment industry, and they argue that in addition to a lack of appropriate consideration of the plan's impact on residents, the government's still failing to provide a reasonable justification for wholesale demolition and redevelopment of the towers, despite significant social, environmental, and economic costs. Good morning, Nina and Kari.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks so much for coming in. Now, I wanted to ask to start us off, what is Building Action Now, or BAN? When did you form and why?
Well, BAN is a coalition from kind of the broad church of the built environment industry, and we formed to demand more evidence-based housing policy, particularly in the light of, as you said, the government's recent, well, semi-recent announcement to demolish the public housing towers, which are our public assets, without providing sufficient evidence that this was, you know, the best and only option, as they're arguing. So we've recently formed, in the last couple of months or so, to try and provide a united voice from the built environment that calls for due process to be followed. So both Kari and I are architects, registered architects, and many other built environment professionals are bound by ethical codes requiring evidence-based and sustainable practice. And the government aren't following these protocols themselves. So our demands are simply for the government to follow a transparent and evidence-based process with our public assets. So as you said, we've prepared an open letter, which anybody from the built environment industry can sign. And our demands are for an immediate moratorium on the demolition and redevelopment of the towers, until there's a release of all documentation that justifies their demolition, until an independent assessment is conducted by people that don't have any commercial interest in the demolition of the towers. Until there's genuine resident consultation in future designs and plans. And the other thing I'll just say is there are, of course, many really excellent organisations that have formed in response to the government's plans to demolish the towers. There's Save Public Housing Collective, which I've been involved in for a while, 44FU, and Stop the Demo. And they've all brought really strong voices from residents and housing workers. So we wanted to add to this constellation of organisations and the movement with a united voice from the built environment industry that's really calling for an evidence-based process to be followed.
Yeah. Kara, did you want to add anything?
Oh, no, I think what Nina said is great. I think we kind of also just, we formed to sort of, there's a kind of a sentiment in the built industry about whether these things are not just right or wrong, but the correct process to follow. So I think, like Nina said, we didn't want to try to take the role of all these great community organisations that are actually really, really strong advocates, but actually just lend a professional voice of both built environment in terms of, you know, designers and what you might kind of think of as white collar workers, but also those actually on site in trades and things like that. So we're really hoping to have a broad spectrum of support, just saying, you know, what's the basis for this and stop.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think, you know, when there have been challenges from public tenants and from people like, you know, like myself as a housing researcher, bringing forward more of the social and political costs of the redevelopment, there are questions about, you know, the technical expertise upon which we can essentially mount an argument about the validity of the decision to demolish and redevelop the towers. But I think bringing in that built environment perspective is really important as well, because after all, your sector is the group of professionals that are involved really in the day-to-day processes of assessing building construction, design, development in the residential sector. Now, I wanted to ask a bit about the traction that this has had and the conversations that you've been seeing amongst built environment professionals and the kinds of built environment professionals that have been engaging so far.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a very, very soft launch, I guess. So the website only went live maybe a week ago. It's interesting to start to have the conversations with people as the word kind of gets out of what we're trying to do and who we're trying to bring together, because there's a lot of individuals I might support, but feel afraid, basically, to put their name to certain things or their organisations behind the sort of letter. So we have in tacit a sort of agreement, but in general, the sort of response has been really great. So initially, I think, yeah, we've had quite a lot of good conversations, and we're continuing to have so.
Yeah, I would say it's probably just by a product of our networks, because we're... in the design side of things, that a lot of the people that have signed on so far are architects, landscape architects and academics. But yeah, we're really looking for a broader range of people to sign on. So if you're listening and you are in other parts of the built environment industry, construction, project management, trades, please sign on and share.
Yes, and we'll have information in our show notes as well about where people can sign the letter. And I think there has been a lot of conversation initially after the announcement was made about thinking about reviving the green bans and those kinds of initiatives that were, you know, led by the Builders and Laborers Federation in Sydney. And it has been difficult to mobilize in an industry sense. You know, I'm not entirely sure of what the issues are, but Kara, you did gesture to the fact that people might be a bit risk averse around this. But is there anything else that you wanted to mention in that vein about, you know, getting traction for these kinds of concerns amongst built environment professionals?
At the end of the day, it's sort of, there's a point of this that's about transparency. And it's about sort of like the bounded rationality of decisions being made and being sort of forced as the standard that the state is going to use for the next sort of 50 years. And other states are starting to pick up, which is quite problematic. In terms of sort of industry, there's sort of an ethical question, which is, if you know this is unethical and you sort of don't do anything about it, then clearly you're not in an ethical sort of practice, more or less, which doesn't really sit well with sort of the greenwashing of a lot of things. In terms of sort of labor and green bans and things, it'd be great if we had that, but the labor sort of movement in that sort of world doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. So it is really about hopefully connecting with the sort of lived experience of people that actually experience what are the ramifications of this are, and getting people to sort of maybe sort of wrestle with the uncomfortable questions about what might be the projects, the aspects of these projects which are real and true, and what kind of actually is happening and will happen because of them. So,
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I think actions that are taken now will have ramifications for the future. So if the demolitions do go ahead, like what precedent does that set for future both public housing and just sort of like other public assets? If the government can demolish all of these towers without providing any evidence, what does that mean for all of our other public buildings and public spaces?
Yeah, and I mean, at the end of the day as well, you know, both of you are architects, and architects at some point will be brought in to this process if the redevelopment plans go ahead, to then redesign, you know, new spaces for communities, new communities that will be coming in, even though communities will have been displaced that had already existed there and been built, you know, over decades, intergenerational communities of tenants that live in the flats. And I wanted to ask about your perspective as architects about the public housing flats as a form of social or community infrastructure, and about the role that you understand the flats to play as part of the social but also the physical fabric of Melbourne.
I think it's pretty important. So I guess this idea of this sort of cyclical displacement that's happened in Melbourne and across Australia, the idea that these the commission flats, the towers, can just be wiped out sort of at the sort of whim of some public policy that isn't very public at all, it's deeply concerning. So, you know, after waves and waves of displacement, we know from these projects, anecdotally, residents don't return, or very few do. There's massive social, community, health impacts, economic impacts. The communities that are fractured, that are formed here, cannot regroup in the time that once they're gone, they're gone. And we're talking about, obviously, in many cases, the most vulnerable sort of individuals. So it's incredibly difficult to say no to the state when you need a place to live. And it's very difficult to organise when you have so many other sort of stresses and things like that. And I think the groups that have been doing this have been doing so in the face of enormous political and other pressure. You can't replace this once it's gone. So it's probably really important to kind of consider once this happens, it's done. The sort of the models that they're basing things off are generations of models. In 40 years, hopefully we're not sitting here going, remember when there was some public housing in Melbourne, but that looks to be the case.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the construction of the towers themselves came out of a very particular moment in history. It came out of a slum reclamation process, which was also immensely unpopular at the time. But since, you know, these have been an iconic part of the city's landscape. And Nina, as you mentioned, they are a public asset. And I was, wondering if you could connect that sort of infrastructural concern to the publicness of the flats and, you know, talk about maybe their value architecturally or their value, as a built form.
Yeah. I mean, for me, as you said, when the towers came into existence in the 60s and the 70s, they were deeply unpopular, and the process through which they came into existence was deeply unpopular. But they are sort of relics or remnants of a time when the government was building public housing, and now they are systematically dismantling public housing. So as a built form, you know, they are a marker of that period in time. And I think at one point the government was building 25% of housing stock in Victoria. They were also built through prefabricated concrete panelised systems built in a factory in southeast of Melbourne. So the government was investing in local jobs, local technologies and local construction. And I think as a physical form, that's what they stand for as well, when a government was investing in that kind of in those processes, which we're, you know, so far from today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was wondering if you could bring it back to telling us about the contribution that you think that built environment professionals of different kinds can collectively add to this conversation about the high-rise redevelopment program.
Yeah, well, I guess as we've been talking about, we're hoping that we can bring a bit of professional weight and also a voice that sort of calls for how the process that we think should be undertaken in making these decisions about the built environment and how we sort of manage and keep our public assets ongoing. I guess we can also play an educational role and advocate for these best practice processes and, you know, talk about life cycle assessments that need to happen, whole of life carbon analysis and resident consultation, these processes that should be followed. And, you know, also people working in this space already have demonstrated that there are alternatives to demolition and redevelopment. You know, there's been local retrofit studies from both office and Nigel Bertram and other consultants that have done independent studies that show that, you know, the towers can be retrofit. It's possible. And also, you know, look to international examples. You know, in Europe, in North America, lots of governments are putting policies in place to encourage retrofit, and it's standard practice in a lot of other places. Yeah, and as we already talked about, you know, we're hoping to build on the kind of historical legacy of the green bans. So we've got some, you know, shoulders to stand on in terms of built environment workers, you know, banding together to refuse to take parts in projects which are of community environmental harm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, adding to that as well, I think it's important to know that in the lack of transparency on the policy and the evidence which hasn't come to light, and parliamentary inquiry has found, you know, 90% of documents are withheld either in commercial confidence or parliamentary cabinet decision making. But as, you know, built environment professionals, workers, we actually, you know, have expertise in different areas, and we can say, well, you know, we can look at these things and go, the fit for purpose argument, health, hygiene, maintenance, accessibility, energy, all those things can be solved and have been solved, but also they're not justification for demolition. It's that simple. And relying not on one person's opinion or one group's opinion, but actually going, well, actually there's a whole industry of expertise that have a sort of an opinion on this, and we want them to make their opinion heard when nothing else is working.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just to wrap up, how can built environment professionals listening to this program sign the letter, but also get involved in these conversations?
You can sign the letter at buildingaction.now. And at the bottom of the page, there is a link to our Instagram account, which you can follow for updates. And I believe there's a contact form on our website.
Yeah, there is. And we've also got a sort of a little link to community organisations. So even if you aren't in the built environment industry of some way, you can connect into one of these sort of advocacy groups, legal groups, welfare groups. There's a large collection there. We've also we've put on just contact details for your local MP to have the conversation. Sometimes that moves things much faster than anything else. But hopefully we're just hoping for people to share and get involved where they can. And if you have an opinion, essentially, and it's a professional opinion as well, or you have experience, come to the table and make it heard as best you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for all of your efforts, and thanks for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Nina Tori Henderson and Kari Landwehr from Building Action Now, or BAN, and they were speaking with us about a recently launched open letter campaign urging Minister for Housing and Building Harriet Shing to halt plans to demolish Melbourne's 44 high-rise public housing towers. BAN is a group of professionals from the built environment industry, and they argue that in addition to a lack of appropriate consideration of the plan's impact on residents, government has still failed to provide a reasonable justification for wholesale demolition and redevelopment of the towers, despite the significant social, environmental, and economic costs. You can read and sign BAN's open letter at buildingaction.now.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are now joined by my co-organizer at the Center Against Racial Profiling, Ilo Diaz, to unpack the function, declaration, and impact of designated areas in Victoria. Ilo has been tracking the announcement of designated areas around Victoria over the past few years, looking at the frequency and duration of these zones where police are additionally empowered to do things like search people without a warrant, move them along, and remove face coverings. Now, last week, Human Rights Law Centre filed a challenge in federal court against the Victorian Assistant Police Commissioner's recent declaration of the entire Melbourne CBD and surrounds as a designated area for 6 months, starting from November 30th, 2025. This is a serious concern, and I'm hoping we'll be able to unpack the legal challenge more in the new year. But for now, good morning, Ilo.
Good morning, Priya. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So just to start off with, I know you've been doing a lot of work, putting up those designated area alerts on Center Against Racial Profiling's Instagram page, which I think a lot of people have found very, very useful because it does also have a bit of an explanation of what they are and how they work. But can you tell us now, what are designated areas? What justification is required to announce them, and what do they allow police to do?
So we started tracking them early this year. I mean, we've been doing a lot of tracking of them over a number of years, but it's early this year that we started publishing them somewhere that we thought would be easily accessible, like Instagram and social media. There's been a lot of, designated areas have existed for a long time, but I think since it's become more visible to everyone in Victoria, I think it's gotten a lot more profile and a lot more people are concerned about them, which we should have been. I mean, we have been since the very beginning. But yeah, look, a designated area is an area that police justify there's going to be some sort of violence or what there was some sort of violence. They usually refer to like knife crime or edged weapons violence, but it can be any sort of violence that uses a weapon. And they believe that that violence may reoccur in any particular time. And so they'll designate or declare an area, so CBD, or sometimes it's St Kilda, sometimes it's Dandenong, Werribee, you know, some of these LGAs. And they'll declare a designated area for a certain time period. Now, the legislation's a little bit not complicated, but it has lots of layers to it. And so they can declare it for a number of times. I think most of the listeners would know that the Melbourne CBD is a designated area for the next 6 months. And that's because they believe there will be some sort of violence, or has been some sort of violence, and police need extra powers. Now, in the designated areas, police do have extra powers. The power essentially is to circumvent any kind of legal guardrails that they have to search someone. It means an erosion of our rights, essentially. Usually when police want to search you, they need one of two things, either a warrant or a reasonable suspicion that you're carrying something that's illegal. Now, that reasonable suspicion is often flimsy, but it is an important guardrail legally for us to be able to then challenge these searches in courts.
Mm.
Designated areas allows police to circumvent that and say, no, we don't need a warrant, we don't need reasonable suspicions. All we need is for you to step into this area, and then we can search you.
Yeah.
So it's quite a very invasive, very powerful, rights eroding power that police have inside these areas.
Yeah, and it does sound also highly discretionary, coming down to the decisions that police are making in the moment, after being more significantly empowered in these areas. And given the scale of intervention that they're empowered to undertake, how is the public notified about the declaration of a designated area, and how has this notification process changed over recent years?
Yeah, good, great question. I think it is very discretionary. I mean, you know, who police choose to search is obviously something that the Centre Against Racial Profiling has been tracking for years as well, with the work of Dr. Tamar Hopkins, looking at these discretionary searches and looking at who's been targeted with them. So, for example, in the last month or so, maybe 3 months ago, Tamar released a bunch of data looking at reasonable suspicion searches and showed that Aboriginal people are 15 times more likely to be searched than someone who appears white. And so we know that police already do a lot of racial profiling. It's endemic and systemic within that police logic. The way that police need to alert the public of a designated area is through two ways, really. One is through the Government Gazette, which is a thing that no one's ever heard of, right? many people don't know that it even exists. It's the official newsletter of the government. It comes out almost every day. There's a version of it that comes out. So it needs to go into the Government Gazette for it to be legal, essentially. It needs to be declared in there. Or in the Victoria Police website. And so the legislation's a little bit, again, layered, because for certain designated areas to come into effect legally, they need to be declared in both in the Government Gazette and the Victoria Police website. So, for example, one of the things we've been tracking is if they're doing that. And we found out earlier this year, for example, that they weren't doing that. So in four occasions from September, Victoria Police declared a designated area on their website, but not in the Government Gazette, which made it invalid. So there were four occasions in the last few months in which Victoria Police declared a designated area invalidly and potentially searched hundreds of people illegally under that piece of legislation. So it is something that we keep track of. We pass that on to the mainstream media, who reported on that, and then police went back and tried to fix it. It doesn't stop those searches from having happened and that harm having occurred to all those people.
Mm, yeah, and it is really, really serious to see that such significant powers are being exercised while circumventing checks and balances that are supposed to, ensure notionally that there is at least a little less arbitrary application of these powers. As we've seen recently, Human Rights Law Center announced last week that it's brought a legal challenge to the federal court to challenge the recent and unprecedented announcement of Melbourne's CBD as a designated area for 6 months from the 30th of November until the 26th of May next year. What's different about this announcement such that it justifies this kind of challenge?
Yeah, look, the 6 month ones, they only came into place in September, really. It's a change that was, the government said the police were crime poor, they wanted more powers, and so the government earlier this year said, okay, we'll give you more of those metered area powers. It was around the time the change in the bail laws were also coming in, and so a lot of people got up in arms for the bail law stuff, which rightly so. Bail laws have impacted our communities like hugely, but they kind of sneaked this 6 month designated area piece in with that, and so it didn't get a lot of traction back then. But now that it's been declared, and police were saying to us, we won't use it. It's very exceptional. No, and we see like a few months after it's been allowed to do it, they do it. So the 6 month one is. All the designated areas, or most of them, need to have some sort of rationale as to there being or having been violent crime in that area. And so my understanding from the Human Rights Law Center case is that that's what they're challenging. What's the rationale to think that within that six-month period or the whole six-month period, violence will occur, like violent crime will occur? And it's not just any violent crime, it's crimes with weapons. And so I think the challenge really is, what intel does police have to say that a six-month-long designated where your rights are eroded and the guardrails have taken away and you just stepping into the CBD, police are allowed to stop you, search you, tell you to go away, take off your face mask, have all these extra powers. What intel do they have that it's reasonable for them to do it for 6 months nonstop? I think that's the core argument of that case, is to say, surely there is no intel that allows for a 6 month long designated area to take place when police already do 12-hour designated areas, 24-hour designated areas. They already do it for certain events and certain times of the year. What makes this different? Why? Why 6 months?
Yeah, I can imagine that this legal case is going to have significant ramifications, because it's probably going to be testing things like the threshold for making that kind of claim, the sorts of justification that police provide, and potentially setting some benchmarks around what will and will not be legally tolerated in the future. So I can imagine it's something to really keep an eye on, and we're hoping to have Human Rights Law Center on in the new year to discuss some of the specifics. But Ilo, what will you be keeping an eye on over the next few months when it comes to policing within the Melbourne CBD and other designated areas?
Yeah, look, we're all going to keep an eye on that case. I think it's a really important one, something that really will impact the way that police use those powers, and particularly about how our communities want to move through these spaces. Right, these spaces are becoming more and more highly controlled. Designated areas are being declared more and more every year. And so police are trying harder to circumvent these guardrails and control public spaces and particular communities as well. And, I really need to emphasize that designated areas, yes, the CBD one has the most media at the moment, but historically they are declared in shopping centers and train stations where racialized communities live. It's majority in Dandenong, in the West. it's in places where racialized communities live, work and play. That's where these designated areas historically are mostly declared. What I'll be keeping an eye on over this next 6 months, I mean, interestingly, the CBD is 6 months, but the shopping centres, there's four shopping centres that have been declared a designated area for 3 months. That's High Point, Northland, Eastland, and I believe Fountain Gate. So these four long-term designated areas, the CBD and the four shopping centres, really shows that police are targeting a certain community, right? It shows that they're looking at summer, they're looking at shopping precincts, entertainment precincts. They're looking at certain. Who are the communities that go there? There's obviously a targeting of these racialized communities, but also young people.
Mm.
I really believe that the police haven't just thought about just randomly chosen this time frame. They've waited for school holidays to come into place. They are being pressured about these crime, you know, so-called crime crisis, youth offending. And so they're trying to look like they're doing something.
Mm.
And so they've declared these designated areas. The thing to point out, the last final thing to point out, is that designated areas, the Liberty Victoria, the RAP team that they have there, did this amazing study looking at all the designated areas within a certain time year and looking at the individual searches that police made in those in that time. And they found that 99% of the times, they found nothing on people.
Mm.
So it means that 99% of the times, your rights are being violated for no reason, for no good. These don't work. They're invasive. They just keep entrenching that systemic racism that police are going through every time that there's met an area. So that's what I'm going to be keeping an eye on, is who are they searching? And I think I know the answer, but by the end of this summer period, I think we'll have a definite answer on that.
Absolutely. And if you are a young person or the parent of a young person in proximity to any of these shopping centres, or if you frequent the CBD for any reason whatsoever, please get in touch with your local community legal centre if you do experience any concerns or interactions with police during this time, at any time, but specifically during this time. Just, to make sure that you are able to access the legal support that you require while these powers are in force and the challenge is still underway. So, Illo, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And that was Illo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling, who spoke with us about the function, declaration and impact of designated areas in Victoria. And we will have information in our show notes about the Human Rights Law Center legal challenge. And we recommend that you also get in touch with, or sorry, head to the website of the Federation of Community Legal Centers for more information about, your own rights and where you can access legal support if you do experience police interactions in these designated areas. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we're now going to hear an interview with Lana Laham, a disability support worker and community organizer who spoke with Inez about Fun Run for Mutual Aid, a community-powered event bringing people together to move, connect, and raise funds for life-saving mutual aid to Gazan, Sudanese, and First Nations people. The main Fun Run event will take place on Sunday, February 1st, 2026, from 9 a.m. at Footscray Park along the fully paved Maribyrnong River Trail. But you can run or walk on the day or at a time that suits you. And there are so many ways to get involved. So sign up and pledge to raise $1,000 for these important initiatives by asking your friends and family to sponsor you. Details are at bit.ly/funrun4, Mutual Aid. And to find out more, you can also follow them on Instagram at instagram.com/funrun4, Mutual Aid. But for now, here's Lana.
Welcome, Lana, to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm so excited to chat about this really fun community-powered initiative. Could you tell us a little bit more about why the Fun Run for Mutual Aid. I know it's a little bit different from some of the other campaigns that we've been organizing.
So the Fun Run for Mutual Aid is basically an event that we're putting on next year, 1st of February, on a Sunday. It is an opportunity for people to come and join us to do a run or a walk across the Maribyrnong River Trail. The name suggests Fun Run, but people can really opt in any way they feel comfortable. So you can run the trail, you can walk it, you can ride your mobility scooter, your wheelchair. The entire trail is completely paved. So there are a number of ways people can opt in, and there are a few different distances you can choose. So a 2.5K, a 5K, or a 10K, or really as far as you're comfortable, as far as your body wants to go. The idea behind the Fun Run is when you sign up, it's free registration, but when you sign up, you're pledging to get sponsorship for Mutual Aid. So you're asking your friends and family to donate and sponsor you to help support Mutual Aid initiatives that are currently running.
Yeah, that's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're fundraising for?
Yes, so we've got three different initiatives that we're fundraising for. The first one is Osama's Evacuation Fund. So Osama is based in Gaza with his family, his wife, his four children, and his mum. After the last 2 years, he's made the difficult decision to leave Gaza and escape the genocide that they have been surviving. So the first initiative is fundraising to get him and his family evacuated from Gaza. The second fund is the West Mali Protection Fund, which is led by senior Gugutha elder Anisu Hasseldine. Anisu has been protecting her country, Gugutha country, over the last few decades from threats from mining companies and rocket launch companies, with the latest threat being sudden launch that have been affecting the ecosystem on her country. The third initiative is Bakri's ongoing fund for Sudan. So Bakri is currently raising funds for Sudanese communities that are currently being impacted by the genocide, the UAE-backed genocide from the RSF. So the funds that Bakri is raising are going to really urgently needed food, medical supplies, clothing, anything that people are needing there that are impacted by the genocide.
Thank you so much. Very important causes here locally and internationally. And I really have, you know, commended the amount of work that has gone into this campaign on Instagram, on the flyer tiles, on accessibility and COVID precautions. I can imagine that that was really difficult or fun, but having to think about it from kind of all angles. And yeah, I'm wondering if you talk a little bit more about what it's like to, you know, design and promote the event in that way with such care and consideration.
Yeah, it's been a really amazing collaborative effort with the other organisers. We're really hoping to be intentional with this event and make sure that we are approaching it very considered and with care, because the intention of the funds is to provide collective care and support. So it's been a journey. we are doing this completely free. We're just volunteers. That's basically what Mutual Aid is about. But it's tough, and it's also fun and collaborative. If you've been on the Fun Run for Mutual Aid Instagram, you can see the graphics are like really bright and vibrant, and then we have these like cute little characters, so it's been fun to play with those assets. But it has been a lot more work than we thought. When we first came up with the idea for the Fun Run, we were like, oh, we'll bring people out on the day, they'll run from one end to another, and then it'll be done. And then the more we started thinking about it, the more we realize that if we actually do want to put on this event intentionally and considered, and for it to be a safe space for everyone to come and an accessible space for people to come, then we do really need to like sit down and put some effort into it. So yeah, I don't know if that's answered the question, but
no, definitely. I think it's just been really wonderful to see, yeah, such care be put into something that is still, you know, like a physical campaign. But yeah, being able to say like you've thought about a paved park and not having to run 25 kilometers, there's different access points, and being able to walk or bring your pram or bring your dog, or yeah, on your mobility scooter as well. I think that's really lovely. When we think about the day itself, so it starts at 9, mm-hmm. and then there's a barbecue, speeches and raffle. Yes. But guess how does it look like on the day? Do people all start at the same time? What happens?
So we're going to have a few different starting points for people that are going to arrive at different times. We're going to make a post closer to the event day that shares the like kind of staggered start times. As well, we know people have, you know, different speeds, different paces that they like to complete their trails. So we've factored in about 3 to 4 hours for the run or the walk itself, or however you're going to participate, so that people have enough time to complete the course. At about 12 p.m., we are going to have food going, and then we will, once we've seen that a whole bunch of our runners and walkers, all of our participants have come back, we will draw the raffle and have a little speech and just share a few words about why it's important for us to come together, the importance of mutual aid, and yeah.
Yeah, amazing. And thinking about the importance of mutual aid, I know that a lot of us have been thinking about it more and more and trying to engage with it as a collective practice in so many different ways. And I'm wondering, yeah, if you could also speak to what it means to have mutual aid that is in solidarity, that's not just charity, that is like, yeah, meeting people's survival needs, but also alongside the work that we're all kind of doing to work for a better world.
I think it means, in this context, I think mutual aid means like a collective effort, a collective coming together to meet people's needs. So the thing that we really enjoy about the structure of this event is that it's not just the organizers putting in the work to raise the money, it's on the participants as well to reach out to friends and family, to have those conversations about mutual aid, to have those conversations about the initiative, so more people are aware, more people understand what's going on, and that we can come together to raise those funds. So at the end of the day, we've all put in the effort to get the money to the communities that we're in solidarity with. And it does feel like we're doing it together. It doesn't feel like the onus is just on us as the organizers. It is a collective responsibility.
Yeah, beautiful. It's so wonderful to see a participant-led collective response. And I think finally, yeah, how do we sign up, start fundraising, yes, and campaigning for ourselves and, yeah, like making, getting the name out there?
So you can find us on Instagram at funrun, the number 4, mutual aid. And that will give you all of the information that you need about the fun run and how to sign up. If you aren't on Instagram, we do have a link, which is bit.ly/funrun4mutualaid. On our grassroots campaign, you can sign up. Registration is free, like we said, and then you are pledging to raise a minimum amount of somewhere between $500 to $1,000 in sponsorship. So if you sign up now, you still have about 6 weeks to get those donations, and we will most likely keep that open for another week or so after for people to gather donations after the event. So once you do sign up, you have access to a toolkit and graphics that will give you kind of everything you need to contact friends and family. We've got message templates, email templates. We've got graphics for social media and Instagram. So like everything in that toolkit is primed to help you be successful.
Yeah, amazing. And could you give us the details again for when the fun run is and where?
Yes, so it is happening next year, Sunday, February the 1st, 9 a.m. at along the Maribyrnong Footscray Trail. The check-in point will be at Footscray Park. So if you either go to our Instagram or to our grassroots campaign, there is a map that will show you how to access our check-in point. The map is a completely paved route to the check-in point, so it's accessible. And yeah, we'll see you there.
Yes, see you there. And we'll have all of that linked in our show notes. But before I let you go, Lana, is there anything else that you'd like to share about this campaign?
We really do need your help to get this campaign out there for people to know about it. It is, it's when I say it's like a collective effort and collective responsibility, it's people who hear about it, people who see it on social media, even if you can't donate, if you can't sign up, sharing is really, really helpful for us. It really helps build an understanding, a bigger understanding of mutual aid. It helps to build bigger awareness for what is happening for the communities that we are in solidarity with. So yeah, if you see anything about the Fun Run for Mutual Aid, please share, please send to friends and family, and if you can, please donate.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us here today on 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And everybody, sign up for a Fun Run for Mutual Aid and click on the links in our show notes. Have a good day.
And that was a conversation between Inez and Lana Laham, a disability support worker and community organizer, speaking about Fun Run for Mutual Aid, Sunday, February 1st at 9 a.m. Footscray Park. And again, you can head to instagram.com/funrun for mutual aid for more information. And we will have details in our show notes. That's all we've got time for today on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Now, quick recap of what we covered. We started off with a conversation between Danielle and Chev, originally broadcast as part of 3CR's Disability Day special broadcast on the 3rd of December 2025. We then heard a conversation with Beck Smith from QLife about the challenges of the end of year period for queer people and some resources and information about how to navigate that time. We caught up with Nina Torrey Henderson and Kari Landwehr from Building Action Now, or BAN, about a recently launched open letter campaign urging Minister for Housing and Building Harriet Shing to halt plans to demolish Melbourne's 44 high-rise public housing towers. We then heard from Ilo Diaz from Centre Against Racial Profiling about the function, declaration and impact of designated areas in Victoria. And as we just said, finally, we were joined by Lana Laham speaking about Fun Run for Mutual Aid. That's all we have time for on Thursday Breakfast this week, and we will catch you in the new year. Our first live show back for 2026 will be on the 22nd of January, but remember to stay tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast and to 3CR 855 AM more generally, as we'll have lots of amazing special summer programming, including a curated selection of our favourite interviews across 2025 for the Thursday Breakfast show. We'll catch you next year.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.